Welcome to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education. Very happy you're here tonight. I have to say this has been a really great run of Tuesday evenings. I have truly enjoyed this spring season, and I see some familiar faces. I hope you have as well. I kind of do these things for myself, you know, so I always hope that you benefit. I'm happy to announce that curator and provocateur Dan Cameron is going to be here next week, the April 12th slot that was a TBA for a while. I landed Dan Cameron. I'm very proud of myself. Dan is of the New Orleans Prospect One fame. I think most of you probably are familiar with him. But if not, a quick search will confirm that he is definitely one of the good guys. So don't miss this opportunity. I think he's probably going to let us in on some things about Prospect Two. So you guys are going to get the news before everybody else. So mark your calendars and be here next Tuesday. I'm also impressed with the Sunday tours that we've been doing each Sunday at 1 p.m. The array of perspectives on the work of Ed Ruscha alone has been amazing. A lot of people have decided to focus on that for their tours, and this coming Sunday is no exception. We have the always enlightening Dr. Frances Colpit is going to be here to talk about Ruscha's work. She has some special insights being from the West Coast herself, and is actually very excited about the exhibition, so I think it should be good fun for everybody. So I'll see you Sunday, 1 p.m., top of the stairs. And then there's tonight's presentation. This is, I have to say, something that I have been looking forward to since first meeting Simon Lee. Work and learn that he actually was the person responsible for Bus Obscura, a beautiful piece, I think, in which a bus operates as a camera obscura as it moves through a city. I believe it was originally for the 2004 Art Basel Miami Beach. Working in photography, video, and installation, Simon has been recognized with grants, fellowships, and residencies, including the Pollock Krasner grant and the New York Foundation for the Arts Fellowship. He is represented in New York by Christine Tierney Gallery, and exhibitions in just the past year have included Shadow Over Land at Gallery Senda in Barcelona, Zebra Poetry Film Festival in Berlin, Loop Video Festival, also in Barcelona, and Where is the Black Beast, shown in 2010 at Short Attention Span Cinema, IFC, in New York, and recently selected to show at the prestigious Rotterdam Film Festival this year. Where is the Black Beast is, of course, the reason that many of you are here tonight. It is going to be, at least in part, the focus of tonight's presentation. And based, as I understand it, on Crow, the Life and Songs of Crow by the poet Ted Hughes, this film has been described as a collaboration with hundreds of anonymous photographs, which I assume will be discussed, to realize the intensity of Hughes' poetry in cinematic form. Simon's known collaborator on this piece and others is accomplished musician Algis Kizis, and who is, in addition to collaborating with Simon, has worked with Matthew Barney, Eve Sussman, Lydia Lunch, Nels Klein, Alex Hockey, and others. Algis is here tonight with Simon to share in the Q&A at the close of the presentation. And while I was going to kind of just stick to his accolades as they apply to his work within art, I've learned recently that I should really mention that he's been a part of several great bands, one of which was the Swans. So John, our technician, kind of dropped his jaw when he heard that, so I thought I would pass that on. And since we want to have plenty of time for tonight's presentation, I'm going to stop there. Although there's so much more to report on both of these guys, I'm going to stop there so we can get started. So please join me in welcoming Simon Lee and Algis Kizis.
Thank you. Am I on? I'm on. Okay. Okay, great. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you, Terry. That was very nice. And thank you generally to the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. It's a fantastic place. I'm very happy to be here. And thanks to Michael Moore, who sort of did all the arrangements, and also a big thanks to John Knuckles up in the booth there, who's making everything work properly, we hope. Well, we'll see. Okay, so as Terry says, yeah, we're going to be watching The Black Beast in... I call it The Black Beast. It's actually called Where is the Black Beast? In a little while. And afterwards, Algis and I will be very happy to take your questions or listen to your comments. But first, I'm going to show you, I think it's three or four pieces of work that... it's not a sort of a clear path that led up to the making of this film. It's not a clear path at all, really. But there is some kind of an arc there that I think it's worth just taking a quick look at. I, some time ago, was working with a physics teacher in a New York City high school. We were collaborating together. And I had a perception that cinema is a phenomenon that is all around us all the time. And that it needed to be teased out into the real world and made visible. Everything That Ever Happened was one of the first pieces I made with this idea in mind. I mean, I agree it's something, a slightly fanciful idea, but if you'll just bear with me a little bit, maybe you'll begin to see somehow, some way that I sort of mean this. Everything That Ever Happened is an ironic title to a simple cameraless animation. Ah, great, thanks, Light. I'm just going to give you a verbal description of the piece. This is obviously a picture of it. A labyrinth of glass panels layered with dust drawings. In the center of the labyrinth, a powerful light pointing up to a slowly turning convex mirror. The mirror reflects the light onto the dust-layered panels as it scans slowly around the gallery, projecting the drawings onto the gallery walls. Because the mirror is convex, the projected images appear to grow and diminish as the light arrives and then leaves, before moving on to the next image. Show you some other images. I think that was, you could see most of what was going on there. In a way, the drawings are really monoprints. They're simple pieces of furniture and common architectural motifs that have been printed onto the glass by disassembling the original pieces into their constituent parts and then reassembling them piece by piece as templates that are sprayed with water and then sprinkled with dust. Thus, you get this accumulation of negative impressions left on the glass, which the light, as it passes across the drawings, animates onto the wall. So here... Oh! Do I have a pointer? Oh, I do have a pointer. How nice. Like here you can see a disassembled sofa. There's a sort of skeleton of a sofa. And what I'm really trying to say is that there are many, many impressions taken of the sofa with different layers of dust. So a certain sort of thickness accumulates, and it's this that gets put onto the gallery wall, projected onto the gallery wall. I like that the viewer, by walking into the gallery, becomes part of the machine. They actually get invited directly inside the camera, although as such there isn't a camera, and inside the projector. The dust is everyday household dust collected from friends' vacuum cleaners. Nothing too special about it. But there is something a little important about the dust in that I'd come up with the idea that if you could examine the dust closely enough, you would be able to discover everything that ever happened. And that's where the title came from. Okay, so just to give you... as I say, this is actually a fairly oldish piece of work, and the video I have for it is really low grade. Nevertheless, I do think it gives you an idea. Could we play the first video, please? going. Because I what? Oh, I see. Well, it wouldn't be the same if we didn't have a few technical hitches. Ah, there we go. So here you see, I'm just going to play a few seconds of this, but you can see, you get the general idea. It's a very slow, contemplative piece, rather like, I mean, actually one friend sort of described it as a kind of Stone Age piece of cinema. And it took about 2 minutes for the light to go around the room, and of course it was very repetitive. It was on a loop. You know, this sort of simple image making. Actually, one of the things that happened also was that the texture of the sheetrock, because it was just simple sheetrock, and the texture of the projected dust had a little conversation together, which I think was interesting, and was actually kind of reminded me a little bit of Pixels, and which, of course, so it sort of made a reference to something of a much more modern technology. I think that's about to end, and I'm going to move on. Okay. Terry has already mentioned Vas Obscura, but I want to really talk about it a bit more, because it was... I did think of Vas Obscura as a film, although a very sort of idiosyncratic one. I guess most people will be familiar with Camera Obscura, the Italian translation being Dark Room. This here, Kirsch's 1646 etching of the phenomena, gave me an idea that eventually led to Vas Obscura. What is important about it is the double skin of screens, the inner screen being a back projection screen. So, maybe I'm just not allowed to do that. So here is the inner screen, and this is clearly a back projection screen, and this is clearly a blackout with a hole in it. So what this meant was, what sort of made me think about this was that it left the inner interior space, the inside space, where the man is standing, is clear of light beams and allows him to see unimpeded images on all sides of his box. So my idea was to take this general technique and install it on a moving bus. And as Terry mentioned, the first bus was in Basel, the Basel Miami Art Fair, and this is it. It's a passenger bus converted to a multiple aperture camera obscura using the back projection technique that is detailed in the Kirscher print. As the bus moves down the street, the individual images flow into one another and a 360-degree animated panorama is created inside. In some ways, you could perhaps call it a cinema obscura. I suppose this idea could be realized in many different types of vehicle, from car, boat, train, etc. But I chose a bus for several reasons. Primarily, a bus is similar to a cinema in the sense that people get on it and sit next to each other, like in a cinema, and watch the passing cityscape as they move through it. People do the same on a train, of course, but a train moves in as straight a line as possible and at a constant speed, or tries to move at a constant speed. And so a bus, which stops and starts much more often, turns sharp corners and generally has to mingle with the other road users on a kind of ad hoc basis. And this offers a greater possibility for a kind of narrative drama. This slide picture gives you a fairly clear idea of what one of the windows looked like when the bus was stationary. Each image is individual in that they are all from slightly different points of view. When the bus begins to move, the apertures will begin to swap their points of view with each other, and a two-dimensional animation of the world outside is created. We took the bus to 9 different cities in Europe, America, and once in Africa. And here it is crossing the equator in Uganda. And that's what it looked like on the inside as it crossed the equator. So I think it's important to say that each version of the piece had its own soundtrack. I started out with commissioned soundtracks from musicians Colleen Burke and Walter Sipser, who made recordings that were played while the bus moved through the various cities. But what I most wanted to do was have live music being played on the bus as it moved, rather like the piano player or small orchestra that would play during the silent movies of that era. We did actually manage to achieve the live thing a couple or 3 times, once in Warsaw, once in San Francisco, and once really memorably with an opera singer in Pittsburgh. It was great. Okay, so Bus Obscura takes an ordinary activity, riding the bus, and transforms it into something different by the application of simple physical laws. It's driven by the conventional movement of the viewer through time and space, but yields results which are unconventional. I'm going to show you... I also just would like to say that I like the idea that the bus, a little bit like everything that ever happened, I like the idea that the bus becomes both the camera and the projector. The audience sits inside, and the movement of the bus creates the narrative. So in a sense, it has all the paraphernalia of cinema, but it's deployed in an extremely economical way. So I'm going to show you a documentary of some of the cities that Bus Obscura visited, which will give you an idea of what it looked like when it was in action. If we could do the second movie, please. I hope that gives you something of a more visceral idea of what it was like to travel on the bus. And it was very much a piece that you had to experience. There is a little there are other little documentaries like that, but really the purpose, one of the sort of logos of the whole project was something like Make the Journey. I'm forgetting it a little bit. I think it said it on the... On the first Miami bus, but it was just that idea of you've got to get on the bus to make the journey to experience this piece. Right, Connecticut Bed and Breakfast. I'm going to show you a part of this piece in a few minutes, but first I want to show you something from another project. Parade of Artificial Things, which is an ongoing work that I'm currently engaged with. The idea with Parade is to create an animation through the movement of light and the deployment of a back projection screen, similar to the one used in the Bus Obscura. And so with that in mind, here are some video test clips that give you a sense of what it looks like. Of the clips, there is a short improvisation that Algis and I did with our friend Kazuki Sugi, where we give this basic technique idea a simple narrative, and we'll play that one through. So if we could play the third video, please. So basically, a static object filmed by a static camera becoming animated when light moves across it and projects it onto a screen. Sometimes I think it's like the light becomes the camera. I mean, I know that's not true, but sometimes it feels like that. I think actually it's also a very common everyday occurrence. And you see it most often when an exterior world is projected into an interior world. For instance, when headlights scan across a building and project everything in their path, the trees, lampposts, fences, etc., onto the walls inside the building. I expect most people have had that experience. I think there are other examples of it, and in some ways we're kind of a little bit blind to it, maybe. I mean, we ignore it, I think. But I think it's always very beautiful and always really quite informative about things, spaces, objects, and so on. Here's the little impro that Al and Sugi did. It's a couple of minutes long, but I think we're going to watch it all. That's it. It's actually, while I was watching it, we actually shot that a while back and kind of forgot about it and discovered it just in the middle of last week. And we were talking, Al and I are talking about putting a sound to it. And I don't know, I kind of enjoyed it watching it silent just now. I don't know. I mean, I think it refers to that whole silent, fairly droll, nothing really happening kind of feeling, and I don't know. So anyway, we should discuss that, didn't we? Okay. Yeah, Connecticut Bed and Breakfast. This is... the idea here was to take this phenomenon and attempt to exploit it into a kind of noir genre movie that takes place in a hotel room. To give a little more background to the piece, the idea was that because everything is projected onto the hotel room and its furniture, the room itself would become a character in the piece. In that sense, that the hotel room becomes a repository of images, like any hotel room is the witness of an endless stream of guests who behave in perhaps slightly uncommon ways, purely because they are in a hotel room. All of the light in the room comes from the exterior of the building, shining in through the windows. And I'm using multiple lights on a tracking system. So the lights could move from one window to the next and then around the building, around the corner of the building. So as well as creating a multi-layered and fragmented image, the intention was to heighten the feeling of being an observer, someone that has to piece the narrative together from the snatched instances available. This soundtrack is by Jim White and is also intended, in a sense, to heighten the viewer's detachment from the events observed. Usually, this piece itself, is shown as a loop. I'm just going to show you, like, the first 2 minutes of it or something like that, so you get the idea. Could we have the fourth piece, is it? Maybe we should stop it there, I'm going to move on. Let me just find the right place here. So we're going to move to the kind of main event now, which is play Where is the Black Beast? As Terry also sort of mentioned, Where is the Black Beast is very much based in still photography. It's made from hundreds of found amateur snapshots taken by many different people with many different cameras in many different parts of the world, probably over the past 80 years or so. These are some of the stills from the piece. I have been collecting amateur snapshot photos for many years. In fact, I became a little bit obsessed with them. And partly because each photo is a unique flash of light that has been chemically bonded to a piece of paper. And also because with the arrival of digital photography, this process is, of course, becoming increasingly rare. In fact, although we take many more photographs today than we ever have before, I think, I'm just assuming that, less and less of them actually get printed onto paper. It's much more usual to see this type of photograph electronically, i.e. like we are this evening or on a computer or whatever. So aside from collecting these photos for their content and increasingly rare means of production, I also had the idea that they were like the cut-up and scattered frames of a film that could be pieced together again, rather like the reconstructing the dust to find out what happened in the first piece that I showed you. So this thought of actually bringing the film together
coalesced into a solid idea around Ted Hughes' monumental cycle of poems, Crow, from the Life and Songs of the Crow. Hughes wrote Crow towards the end of the 1960s. He uses the image of a crow to depict humanity, and it is quite a dark, poetic vision. If any of you know, Hughes's work, quite a lot of his work had its dark side. The soundtrack is composed and played by Algis, who's here this evening, and he was also responsible for the recordings of the voices. We auditioned many people to read for this film, most of whom, or many of whom anyway, were not professional performers. It became quite a difficult and exacting task to find the right delivery and voice for the right poem. To come back to my original thoughts about cinema being all around us all the time, these snapshot images are ubiquitous, taken by many different people with many different cameras, each with their own idea of composition and focus and exposure, etc. The photographs in the film are all abandoned, found in flea markets and junk stores and garage sales. In that sense, the film was already shot. It just had to be found and pieced together. So I think we should show it now. And I hope you enjoy it. And then, as I say, Algis and I will be very happy to answer questions or take comments afterwards. Thank you.
Lineage. In the beginning was Scream, who begat blood, who begat eye, who begat fear, who begat wing, who begat bone, who begat granite, who begat violet, who begat guitar, who begat sweat, who begat Adam, who begat Mary, who begat God, who begat nothing, who begat never, 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 never. Who begat Crow? Screaming for blood, grubs, crusts, anything. Trembling, featherless elbows in the nest's filth.
As a boy was Oedipus, stuck in his mammy's belly. His daddy walled the exit up, he was a horrible fella. You stay in there, his daddy cried, because a dicky bird has told the world when you get born you'll treat me like a turd. His mammy swelled and wept and swelled, with a bang he busted out. His daddy stropped his acca when he heard that baby shout.
Thank you.
Oh, do not shop his winkle off, his mammy cried with horror. Think of the joy will come of it tomorrow and tomorrow. But Daddy had the word from God. He took that howling brat. He tied its legs in crooked knots and threw it to the cat. But Oedipus, he had the luck, for when he hit the ground, he bounced up like a jack-in-a-box and knocked his daddy down. He hit his daddy such a whack, stone dead his daddy fell. His cry went straight to God above, his ghost it went to hell. The dicky bird came to Oedipus, you murderous little sod. The Sphinx will bite your bollocks off, this order comes from God. The Sphinx, she waved her legs at him and opened wide her maw. Oedipus stood stiff and wept at the dreadful thing he saw. He stood there on his crooked leg, the Sphinx began to bawl. 4 legs, 3 legs, 2 legs, 1 leg, who goes on them all? Oedipus took an axe and split the Sphinx from top to bottom. The answers aren't in me, he cried, maybe your guts have got 'em. And out there came 10,000 ghosts, all in their rotten bodies, crying, you will never know what a cruel bastard God is. Next came out his daddy dead and shrieked about the place. He stabs his mammy in the guts and smiles into her face. Then out his mammy came herself, the blood poured from her bucket. What you can't understand, she cried, you sleep on it or sing to it. Oedipus raised his axe again. The world is dark, he cried. The world is dark 1 inch ahead. What's on the other side? He split his mammy like a melon. He was drenched with gore. He found himself curled up inside, as if he'd never been born.
Began under the groan of the oldest forest. It ran through the clouds, a third light, and it ran through the skin of the earth. It came circling the earth like the lifted bow of a wave submarine, running, tossing the willows and swelling the elm tops, looking for its occasion. But people were prepared. They met it with visor smiles, mirrors of ricochet, smiles that stole a bone and smiles that went off with a mouthful of blood and smiles that left poison in a numb place or doubled up, covering a getaway. But the smile was too fast. It outflanked all. It was too tiny. It slipped between the atoms so that the steel screeched open like a gutted rabbit. The skin was nothing, then the pavement and the air and the light confined all the jumping blood, no better than a paper bag. People were running with bandages, but the world was a drafty gap. The whole creation was just a broken gutter pipe. And there was the unlucky person's eye, pinned under its brow, widening for the darkness behind it, which kept right on getting wider, darker, as if the soul were not working. And at that very moment, a smile arrived, and a crowd shoving to get a glimpse of a man's soul stripped to its last shame met this smile that rose through its torn roots, touching his lips, altering his eyes, and for a moment, mending everything, before it swept out and away across the earth.
Where is it?
When Crow was white, he decided the sun was too white. He decided it glared much too whitely. He decided to attack it and defeat it. He got his strength flush and in full glitter. He clawed and fluffed his rage up. He aimed his beak direct at the sun's center. He laughed himself to the center of himself. And attacked. At his battle cry, trees grew suddenly old. Shadows flattened, but the sun brightened. It brightened and Crow returned charred black. He opened his mouth, but what came out was charred black. Up there, he managed. Where white is black and black is white, I won. Disgusted with man, turned towards heaven.
Once upon a time there was a person, almost a person. Somehow he could not quite see. Somehow he could not quite hear. He could not quite think. Somehow his body, for instance, was intermittent. Thank you. He could see the bread he cut. He could see the letters of words he read. He could see the wrinkles on hand skin he looked at, or whenever of a person, or an ear, or a food, or the other food. But somehow he could not quite see. Nevertheless, the Grand Canyon spread wide open like a surgical operation for him. But somehow he had only half a face there, and somehow his legs were missing at the time. And though somebody was talking, he could not hear. Though luckily his camera worked okay. The seabed lifted its privacy and showed its most hidden fish thing. He stared, he groped to feel, but his hands were funny hooves just at the crucial moment. And though his eyes worked, half his head was jellyfish. Nothing could connect. And the photographs were blurred. A great battleship broke into with a boom, as if to welcome his glance. An earthquake shook a city onto its people just before he got there with his rubber eyes, clockwork ear. And the most beautiful girls laid their faces on his pillow staring him out, but somehow his eyes were in the wrong way round. He laughed, he whispered, but somehow he could not hear. He gripped and clawed, but somehow his fingers would not catch. Somehow he was a tar baby. Somehow somebody was pouring his brains into a bottle. Somehow it was already too late. And was a pile of pieces under a blanket. And when the sea monster surfaced and stared at the rowboat, somehow his eyes failed to click. And when he saw the man's head cleft with a hatchet, somehow staring blank swallowed his entire face just at the crucial moment, then disgorged it again whole. As if nothing had happened. So he just went and ate what he could, and did what he could, and grabbed what he could, and saw what he could, then sat down to write his autobiography. But somehow his arms went just bits of stick. Somehow his guts were an old watch chain. Somehow his feet were two old postcards. Somehow his head was a broken window pane. "I give up," he said. He gave up. Creation had failed again.
Out under the sun stands a body. It is growth of the solid world. It is part of the world's earthen wall. The earth's plants, such as the genitals and the flowerless navel, live in its crevices. Also, some of Earth's creatures, such as the mouth. All are rooted in earth, or eat earth, earthy, thickening the wall. Only there is a doorway in the wall, a black doorway, the eye's pupil. Through that doorway came Crow, flying from sun to sun. He found this home.
The without eye, black the within tongue, black was the heart, black the liver, black the lungs unable to suck in light, black the blood in its loud tunnel, black the bowels packed in furnace. black too the muscles striving to pull out into the light. Black the nerves, black the brain with its tombed visions. Black also the soul, the huge stammer of the cry that swelling could not pronounce its son. Black is the wet otter's head lifted. Black is the rock plunging in foam. Black is the gall lying on the bed of the blood. Black is the earth globe 1 inch under. An egg of blackness where sun and moon alternate their weathers to hatch a crow.
Beginning was scream, who begat blood, who begat eye, who begat fear, who begat wing, who begat bone, who begat granite. Who begat violet? Who begat guitar? Who begat sweat? Who begat Adam? Who begat Mary? Nothing. Who begat never? Never. 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 Who begat crow? Screaming for blood, grubs, crusts. In the nests, filth.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for watching that. If anyone does have anything they want to talk about, then we'd be more than happy to do it. I think Algis has never really been properly introduced yet. So. Algis Keezys.
Thank you. Thanks for coming out. It's very nice to see everyone here in beautiful Fort Worth.
Actually, there is a... Gosh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to answer this question, but there is a slight backstory in that I discovered this poetry for myself when I was about 17 or 18 or something like this, and it had an extremely powerful effect on me in a very kind of dark, adolescent way. And... I was already starting to be an artist at that time, and a lot of my not very good drawings and paintings at that time sort of turned out to be kind of like trying to do something with Crow. And then I actually got together with a filmmaker friend, and we said, yeah, we've got to make a film. And we wrote a script, and we wrote to Ted Hughes, said we want to make a film, and he said, all right, you can do it. You've got 2 years, but you don't have rights, and so on. And so, as I say, we wrote a script, and started making very, very different film to what you've just seen now. And the whole thing went up in flames in about 6 months, where we, started arguing with each other about various responsibilities and so on and so on. Typically, kind of. Sort of young adult, and I've unfortunately never spoken to that guy ever since, or he to me. And so why did I want to make it? You've got to actually cut. I wanted to make it then because it was so powerful to me then, and I think I probably wanted to make it in a fairly, like I say, adolescent way. You've kind of got to cut to 20 years or so later. When I'm standing by one of Algis's bookshelves at a party, actually, and I see Crow, Life and Songs of the Crow, and Al's standing there. I say, oh man, isn't that a great book? And he basically has the same kind of relationship with it, i.e., a certain obsession from long ago, and so it reawakened. Well, first of all, it reawakened me to go back and read the poetry again, which I probably hadn't done in quite a while, to find that, I really had still very strong feelings for it and that nothing had really diminished, actually. Maybe I'd got a little bit more mature, but, the poetry was still, extremely live, sort of present for me. And then it was a couple of months after that where I think we even at the party sort of said, well, we should make a film, and, sort of cheers, and so on. And then a couple of months after that, like I said in the talk, this idea of collecting the photographs, which I'd been doing for a while with the idea of making a film, and it all just kind of collided and gelled together. And I took the idea to Al, and then we started this back and forth of working, finding, finding voices, picking poems, etc., etc. But I don't know if that really why, but it's something of a... yeah.
I don't know which one you're speaking about specifically.
I think it's the Mafia Walk.
Mafia Walk, but...
And it's the
The reed sounding instrument? Oh, it's a little $4 Casio keyboard. I think that's the one you're talking about. It does this little simple melody over the top of it, right? Yeah. The idea for that, I was thinking when I was just watching it again, I was like, oh yeah, this was what it was originally designed to be, which was in that same sort of, actually the beginning of that, there's like a cabin in the woods, right? Is this the same one you're talking about? Yeah, okay. So I was looking at the cabin in the woods, which is one of these stills that Simon said. I have these photographs slash these film clips that he's scanned.
Yeah. I'll talk a bit about that in a minute. Mm-hmm.
But he sent me this this JPEG, and I was looking at it, and I thought it was one of the greatest things I've seen. And so I imagined in the world of in this alter existence of Crow, a thing where what would be. There would be a radio inside the cabin, and I would be walking in the woods next to the cabin, and I would hear the radio out of there. And in that alternate existence, gothic pop would be like the sound coming out of that. So I was like, okay, let me create a gothic pop song. What would that be? And then the idea was that it wouldn't be so clear, but it would be a little more like it would be coming out of this old radio. But that's not exactly what happened. What happened was this little more cleaner piece, but that's the idea of why that was composed like that. It's supposed to be goth pop, if that doesn't exist, but it does in the universe of Crow.
Most of the instrumentation, though, was it acoustic and then processed some?
Most of it was acoustic. Basically, everything I try to do, I try to manipulate in some way or another. I like to take things that are one thing and make them into another. There's this... sort of like this organic sort of evolution of things, and that's basically what it is. But I tend to like not treat anything except in a very sort of weird way. Like I'm like tons of effects, but there are some effects on things. But generally, just like with manipulations of different kinds, stretching and time shifting and things like this. To me, it's a much purer way of attacking something or making it into a cooler thing. And so the instrumentation of that particular thing is like, yeah, there's some bottle caps. There's, this Casio thing I got in Florida in this children's store and things like this, you know.
And just one last thing. I really like the sung part.
Which one?
The part where the reader sings.
Yeah, that's Carla Bozulich. I think that's the one you're...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's awesome, but she's... I don't know if you guys know her, but she used to be in this band called the Geraldine Fibbers back in the day a little bit. And she has this band called Evangelista right now that if you ever get a chance to see, it's one of the best things you'll ever do. And her voice is amazing. That was three questions. Okay, good.
Style-wise, did you draw like any inspiration from the French New Wave movement? Because the way that this film plays is a lot like this one called La Jetée.
Yeah.
It's by Chris Marker. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen La Jetée. Everyone tells me I should go and see it. And everyone is enormously surprised that I haven't seen La Jetée.
That was inspiration for 12 Monkeys.
It was?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
The storyline in La Jetée was made by the Hollywood
thing
for 12 Monkeys.
I didn't know that, right, yeah. Directly sort of no. To that, and there was a little bit of a reason for that in that I was a little bit frightened to see it. I think I could go and see it now, having got this one sort of under my belt a little bit. Sort of the broader part of the question, I don't want to sound like an idiot, but I'm not quite sure what to say was the sort of visual aesthetic influence, filmically at least, cinematically, for doing it. As I say, it's really what I consider to be the first film that I've made. I mean, it's the first film Alan and I have made, but it's also the first film that I've made. And I don't sort of view myself as a filmmaker as much as an artist. And I am making another film right now. I don't know if it'll ever see the light of day, but it's difficult to, I'm not, being a novice at it, I think I just sort of jumped into the swimming pool, and what came out in terms of style and you know, ways of telling a story. I think that would be the best way of putting it. And
are you still collecting pictures?
I am. yeah, and I think I probably always will. I mean, I'm much less obsessed about it.
Do you go seek them out, or do you, like, I mean, is it sort of a, like, stamp collecting, if you will, just a grand...
It's worse than that, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, if I had time... I actually did. The last time I was here, I got some photos in Fort Worth.
There's a sociologist who's a dumpster diver.
Oh, yeah.
In Fort Worth, and yeah. He has a huge collection of old photographs and never knows what to do with them.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I am still... I'll never be able to stop collecting them. I must say that I'm less... I really am, and I can't explain this because it's only images, but I am less... for some reason, less interested in the digital image. And there's no, why would that be? Why should that, you know? I mean, I think a lot of people sort of have that feeling. But yeah, I'm still collecting. And if I had more time here, this, you know, while I was here, I'd go back out and try and find. It's a fabulous thing to do. I mean, it gives, you find out so much about a place just by, you know, not only looking at the photos, which aren't necessarily from that place anyway, but just by going to the places where you think you might find them and talking to people and so on and so on. So, yeah.
I had a question about the first piece you showed, the Everything That Ever Happened.
Uh-huh.
And you referred to it as the machine, and then with the dust and the shadows, it brought to mind Duchamp's Bride of the Bachelors.
Uh-huh.
And I wondered if that was somewhere in your mind, or doing sort of a riff on it or anything?
I think, maybe a riff on it. Certainly, didn't part of what Duchamp did was to fire matchsticks into the dust, and then so that it had this sort of movement to it, which almost kind of like animated a kind of an animation. I mean, the way was he made that techniques used, I think, you know, I was certainly conscious of it, and the machine. If you're referencing that in particular to Duchamp, was more for me is more I mean, funnily enough, it actually, the whole piece did have a certain look of, like, you know, the one of the main things, the coffee grinder kind of image in that piece, but no, for me it really was to get people into the paraphernalia of the cinema, you know, get them inside the camera, inside the projector. And subsequently, by getting them inside, get them outside of it as well, of course, by them becoming part of the projection.
Love these moments.
Well, I have one other question then, we're probably going to be out of time pretty soon, but I'm listening to you. I think I kind of have a sense of how you guys worked on this. I mean, as I'm watching it, I'm thinking this had to be really responsive, and I'm wondering, did you obviously started at least with the idea of Hughes's work, but I just can't imagine. I mean, it seems like it would be such a back and forth, and you take this photograph and you take this element that seems so irrelevant, had to have seemed so irrelevant in the overall photograph, and find it to be pertinent to, were you trying to match it with the lyrics, or were you trying to avoid matching it with the lyrics? And the same thing with the music, were you
Was it how? What was that kind of activity back and forth, the responsive?
I think it's mostly yours.
I think I probably can speak for Al in my first sort of statement here, which is that the one thing that we both very quickly, right from the get-go, agreed upon was that the text was absolutely sacred, and that everything was a slave to the text. Though hopefully not too slavish. It doesn't look that way, you know. But I think that having sort of established that as a solid idea, we then had to get some recordings of people reading the text. And that was a truly difficult thing to do. From that, and I mean, while that's going on, I'm sure that Al is, coming up with ideas and little bits of music or phrases or whatever, and so on. And I'm at the same time, I'm beginning to look at these photographs in a different way. Because, you know, remember that I didn't collect these photographs to make Crow, you know, or Black Beast. And so that now I'm beginning to look at them in a different way. Plus, suddenly I've got this great project, this film where which I'd always wanted to make out of these things now had a solid backbone to it. And so now I could actually take the photo, not only look at the photos differently, but could put them into a timeline differently with a much more of a sense of purpose. And for me, in that sense, that's how it grew. We eventually managed to get some readings we were happy with. We were both experimenting, in our different fields. And it sort of then became time to do the sort of crossover, to really mix and match it. And maybe Al can take it up there. That was also a long process. But.
Right, I was going to say that initially... I think there was we had this learning curve aspect of the whole this whole thing where Simon had all these photographs that he had to digitize in order to try and manipulate them in some sort of to put them in a timeline and then out of there to sort of like vet what you're going to use, what you're not, you know, all this other stuff. So there was a bit of that thing going on, and at the same time I had the luxury of having some stuff in the can already even before the project. I had these ideas for things. Didn't know what I was going to do with them, but I knew I was going to use them somewhere. Happily, we agreed to work on stuff, and Simon loved some of the stuff I had in the can. So with me, it was a little easy that Simon, that was the first thing, was like, give him some sound. He got to working on some of that sound. At the same time, we were recording people, and that's pretty, it's like... to match another thing about the sort of sovereignty of the word, both Simon and I have so much love for this particular piece of work, the last thing we'd want to do is step on it in any way. And that's an extremely difficult thing to do in both sound and in vision as well. So so there's a delicacy involved there. So that adds to some sort of thing, and we're learning how to do that as well. And so, you put all that stuff together, and then all of a sudden 2 years go by, and what are you going to do, right? So then... We had luckily in those 2 years that we had some things we could use and of some of the voice that which worked amazingly well with the words, and then the images and things started to lock together, and then we decided because this process can go on forever, so we decided to put a to put a stop on it. Yeah. It's like I don't know, and after 2 years we had like exact 30 something minutes of things, so. So it's like, okay, let's stop it here and see what happens with it. So in fact, this is just a work in progress, or a chapter. We're calling it a chapter.
Are other poems that we would like to do.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, and I'm sort of going a little bit off the point, that a 35-minute film is not a popular length of film. It doesn't fit. I was just at the Rotterdam Film Festival and talking with a programmer who likes the work, likes the film a lot, and said, Simon, I'm never, ever going to program this film. And I'm like, why? And she's like, it's the wrong length. It's longer than 15 minutes, which is a short. And, you know, it's what am I going to program this with? Yeah. How am I going to do it? You know, I mean, I think it is all completely possible. I mean, whatever, you know, film festivals, you know, they have their ways and whatever. I just cannot see why that is. But that does bring me on to the point of, is this an art piece? Is this a gallery piece, I mean, or is it a cinema piece? And I think we're both coming to the idea that we think it probably should be a sort of more of a gallery piece than, because it doesn't fit that well in the film world, you know. And then just to change the subject back just quickly, and I'm sure people want to go, but one of the things that Al said to me just about the collaboration was when we were probably at a sort of a tense moment of the collaboration was. And we were looking at a piece that we were trying to pull together, and he said, "You're not dancing with me," you know? And that actually was a huge key for me, you know, to get over various, to think about various ways. I mean, it sounds like a silly thing to say, but it was said just at the right time, right, in the right way, you know, in the right circumstances, and just managed me to creak the door open a little bit, you know.
And so.
Sure. Yeah.
I can't imagine how it ever came to an end. It just seems like I'm glad to hear you say it. In some ways, it's a chapter or in progress.
Bless you.
Well, yeah. We'll see. We do actually have other pieces that we'd like to do. But, you know.
Well, we have to.
Yeah.
Oh.
Because about the distribution, is it possible to actually buy a copy?
Okay, well, this leads a little bit into what we were saying. Is it a cinema piece or is it a gallery piece? It is possible to buy a copy, but there are only 5 copies. We're doing an edition of 5, and they're really quite expensive. So
I'm trying to pay you a compliment. I think it warrants seeing again.
Oh, well, thank you. I wonder if you sort of see the point about whether to distribute it on DVD. I hate watching it on DVD anyway, which is not a reason for not doing it. But yeah, we're trying to sit in the art world, not in the cinema world with it.
Do you ever worry that somebody's going to be watching this and say, "That's me"?
Yeah.
I thought.
How dare you? That's my uncle.
I thought I saw.
Really? Well, who knows? I never really tell anyone this, but there's only one photo in there that I know exactly the provenance of, and that is one of my photos taken with a Brownie camera when I was about 5 years old, and it's a beach scene. It's just flashed up there. It's not there very long, and it's got my dog walking along the beach in it, and my dad snoring on the sand right there, and I mean, it's sort of inconsequential, but I sort of put it in there. But yeah, I don't know if and when that's going to happen. Sorry, did someone want that?
Yeah. I was thinking though, the poetry is so permanent, the words are so permanent, and before we saw the film, we were discussing how we miss these moments of light. When a car drives up and we see the pleats of the fence, you know, in our living room, how we kind of ignore them or don't notice them, or maybe we're in awe of it for a second. And the film being distributed or seen over and over again would take away from that, because the words are permanent. What we just saw and witnessed is temporary. It's just that fleeting moment made us think a little bit.
Right. That's a great point. Yeah. Yeah, I have no objection to people seeing it again and again and again, actually. But I do want them to see it under good circumstances. Well, we both do, you know. I mean, it's got to be like that. Because we're dealing, actually, and part of that is actually that we are, I mean, of course, a photograph has a certain permanence to it, but it's not that permanent. And you know, and especially snapshot amateur photos taken with plastic lenses and, you know, well, maybe not sometimes glass lenses with the older ones and so on and so on. I mean, we're already starting at a we've already got a quality issue when you put it, make it as big as that on the screen. So, yeah.
Oh, one more question. What was the little girl holding the cat at the very
what,
maybe smile
what,
a bit.
That, what was the girl shot with the girl at the cat at the end?
I didn't know if that was humorous or...
Oh, well, kind of. I don't know.
There was this. It was part of this other piece, and we liked this thing so much.
Oh,
we didn't use it, yeah. But we both had this affinity for it. Like, what are we going to do with this? How are we going to keep it? And just have this little. It's this little outro.
Yeah.
Became this outro piece because she's so awesome. You know, it's like you can't.
But it does. It has. It has owls. How does it go? Oh, boom. Well, I can't do it, you know. What, over it. And
it's this ominous, this ominosity about this, you know, this little girl with this cat, you know.
Exactly. Like, and if you saw the whole photo, it's actually, there's a Christmas tree there, there's her little brother with a red truck there, and she's just sort of like doing this. But we've got, you know, yeah. The way it's sort of, dun, 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 it's like Jaws or something.
Mm-hmm. Very intimate.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean that's part of the joy. I mean that's one of the other things actually of collecting photos, and is that in some sense the very first edit of this film was in the junk store and looking at the photo and looking into it and seeing what there's in there and thinking about, you know, in terms of, you know, where you would take the camera. Where you would be the second camera. Also, I mean, I always had the feeling that, you know, I wasn't principal camera, I was second camera. Oh. Do you know what I mean? Like, so...
Who's holding
it? Yeah, we got to go. So, thank you so much.
Thanks for coming out. Thank you.